Kids are stupid everywhere. Saying yes to sex? There are no excuses, schools. No, I have not lost it. By the end of the show, you'll know what I mean. We also welcome the president of the Teachers Union. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From SeattleTimes.com, an editorial, sex education in schools should cover consent. Public schools in King County are right to teach students about sexual consent, including that they should receive an affirmative yes to proceed with sex instead of stopping only if they hear no.
How about that? An editorial from the Seattle Times endorsing a sex education curriculum that goes further than the just say no. Okay. Lot going on here,
yeah,
right?
There is.
Okay, there's a lot going on here, especially the times we're living in. And in fact, the editorial refers to this, the Harvey Weinstein, the sexual harassment, and we've got to do a better job with sex education. And for the longest time, sex education, in fact, can run the gamut of abstinence only, which is, look, that's truly the no means no, and you don't do it. Therefore, there's no pregnancy, no sexually transmitted disease, guaranteed 100% foolproof.
Right.
Okay, abstinence only. The problem with abstinence only is it doesn't work
in
curbing the behavior of 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds.
Right.
Okay. So sex education actually has a really long research record of working, especially if it's done well, done in context, and done seriously. Okay. This, though, is saying that the next step is that we've spent a lot of time teaching students and children. Well, children, okay, yeah, they are.
They're kids.
I mean, we're talking about
kids.
13, 14. I mean, I have a 15-year-old. She's a child. It's not just enough to teach her to say no, but that if there's a relationship issue going on, that they also need to get an affirmative yes.
It's like what you said when we were talking about this earlier. You're teaching someone, yes, I want to have sex.
Right.
Instead of, no, I don't want to have sex.
And
you're turning it totally on edge.
Okay. So is there a parent out there who's going to say in Seattle, wait a minute, you know what? I was fine with no. I'm not happy with the whole idea of talking about yes meaning yes. Okay. Yeah, that's probably going to happen because you know what we know about parents. They're crazy.
It's not probably. It will happen.
Yeah, it will happen.
It will happen.
However, we got to look at what the intent is here, is the clarity. Yes, no means no, but also to understand that yes means yes, because they give a situation, if you go deeper into this in the Seattle Times, in which they present role model situations where a drunk friend who's a woman or a female is being observed by their friends being hit on by a man, by a boy, and the issue is, can she consent in a drunken state? If she says yes, does yes mean yes that at that point?
Right.
And you know, and saying, what do you do when you observe this behavior?
Well, and it, but the, I mean, you can't take every scenario and say, this is how, what you're going to do here, and this is what you're going to do here. So it's like everyone has always said, if they're drunk, it doesn't count.
Right.
You can't take what they're going to say anyway, yes or no, because people are going to say yes and then regret it and say, I didn't mean to.
I didn't mean to. Yeah. So here we have to stay away from this. I think this is a good idea, and I'll push this on the edge because in Busted Pencils, we believe in the edge. Progressive sexual education, continuing, more information is better. The research shows all the time, the more you try to hide from kids the reality of sex, the more it backfires on you. So look, if the idea here, if we're going to avoid the Harvey Weinsteins and continuing this, we also need to teach the reality of what does it mean to say yes.
From Gadfly on the Wall blog. Few kids in the world can pass America's Common Core tests, according to a new study. This is the conclusion of a new study that came out in January called How High the Bar by the National Superintendents Roundtable and the Horace Mann League. They found the benchmarks for passing the National Assessment of Educational Progress and American Common Core tests put success out of reach for most students the world over.
Wait, the world?
The world.
So this is not just us. Wait, so American kids are not alone in their suckiness?
Nope. Apparently everyone sucks.
Wow.
So there's the headline.
Now that should be the real news.
It should be.
All kids across in the world are dumb.
Yeah, they're not passing these tests that apparently they should all be passing.
So now that we now know that all children are dumb, can we now finally move on and get rid of every one of these ridiculous tests, whether it's Common Core, whether it's the National Search for Intelligent Life test, whether it's the STAR test, whether it's the MAP test, whatever test it is.
Junk them.
Because here we're saying, right? And there's a lot more to this story, and there's a lot more depth in it. But I just want to hit it from that point, is to say it finally takes the mask away and shows us that testing really is keeping us from something else. In fact, you point out in later on in this piece a really important quote.
One thing that really stood out to me is after all these graphs and all these tests, it said the whole process hides how well our kids actually do. All the headlines say they're failing, they're below these countries, they're below everything else. They're hiding the good stuff.
Right. See, that's the other sad, insidious, horrendous, keep going, problem with the whole 20 plus year testing regime is that it has shielded us from all of the great things that kids are doing and the things that they can do and the things that they're smart about, mm-hmm. because we've focused on such a small minutia of little skills on a tiny set of tests that we've forgotten to look and go, wow, they can play awesome music. Wow, mm-hmm. they can critically think and build a bridge together. Holy smokes, look at them put together this piece of poetry.
Right.
All of that was lost, but not really. We now know all kids are not dumb. How about maybe tests? All tests are dumb.
This is Busted Pencils on 1510 AM Resistance Radio from Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
The protesting and accountability advocates love for no excuses goes beyond tests. There are actually no excuses schools. Poverty, hunger, hopelessness, that's not an excuse. I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks about no excuses schools.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just
Let's
ask.
Let's think for a minute first about this idea of no excuses. What does it really mean? You know, this word excuse has been around now. It's been part of the Ed Reform movement. And I remember the first time the first person said to me when I was at Lesley University, poverty is not an excuse. And I turned around puzzled because it was the first time I'd heard it. Because I didn't understand that. What do you mean poverty is not an excuse? Well, first of all, who's looking for excuses?
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't it mean an excuse? Doesn't an excuse imply that someone's trying to get away with something? Or, you know, I expect something of you and you better come through no matter what. There's no excuse. But even the very idea of that, to my thinking, does that mean a child comes to school and hasn't had breakfast or is homeless or hasn't seen a parent because the parent had to leave for work at 4 a.m. and the kid got ready on her own? You know, and so we're going to get high grades anyway, even though we don't know, we don't have health care and we didn't have a food. And so there's no excuse for those things. We're going to just buckle down and study these Common Core standards as if we didn't just come out of that situation. The very assumption about this idea of excuses is offensive to me. But it's a widespread idea now. Many people use it. We have no excuses schools. And that means you go to school and you learn all these standards. You learn all these requirements. There's no excuse for not learning them. Mm-hmm. You're all equal.
Mm-hmm.
This is how we're closing the achievement gap here. We're all equal. Forget it that you came from a home with a wealthy home and you come from a poor home. Doesn't matter. No excuse. You're all going to buckle down. And in, and along with that, we have to have also no excuses for any bad behavior. So you have to walk down the hall silently, and you have to have your hands folded behind your back and can't touch another person and so forth. So because there's this whole set of behavioral requirements that seem to accompany the academic requirements of these no excuses schools. And I realize when I think about that, that the very assumption about who human beings are and who children are and how they learn would be different from somebody who adhered to a no-excuses philosophy versus somebody who adhered to a more humanitarian or child-centered philosophy. Because I think with the no-excuses idea, I think it's basically aligned with that empty vessel idea. Like, you kids don't know anything, and I have to tell you all these facts and all this knowledge that comes from the world. I have to pour it into you because you have nothing in your empty head. And furthermore, I have to teach you good behavior because I can't count on you to have any on your own. Versus a more, what you might say, constructivist idea, or an idea that children, young people, participate in learning. They have an active role to play. And that when they learn, it's because they're interacting between what's inside them, the ideas they have in their heads, the feelings they have in their hearts, the knowledge that they're building little by little within them, that's interacting with the experiences that we provide in schools. And that's what knowledge, that's what real learning comes from. That's what real knowledge is built from, is from this active, interactive relationship between the learner and the environment. And those are two fundamentally different ways of looking at learning. And I think this whole no excuses thing is a new version of a very old idea about social transmission of knowledge and empty vessels and blank slates and all those things we've known for a long time were one way to view human beings and learning. But I don't agree with that. And there's no evidence. If you look at child development or developmental psychology, you see that there's a participation of the infant from birth. The active, engaged learner is taking initiative to engage with the environment and learn from the first moments of life. So I think it's really very, very sad. No excuses schools have to depend on coercion. They have to depend on suppression. They have to depend on compliance and obedience. And these are things that will deaden learning and deaden children's souls and spirits. And hopefully, I always keep hoping that even kids who go to schools like this, they're going to find their will and their spirit from within, and they're going to come back.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
23 years ago, he was a fourth grade teacher. Then he was a vice president. And now he is the president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Kim Schrader.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
How does one go from fourth grade teacher to president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association?
There are many mornings I ask myself that when I wake up. All of our presidents have come from the classroom. Okay. They're members. But how I got involved was early on, fourth grade teacher, enjoying myself. Pointed out some inconsistencies in our building and then became a building representative to deal with administration. And actually, I got involved in our union by questioning some political decisions that were made. And then I ended up on the political action committee, and it just kept steamrolling from there.
So in other words, you were one of those people who couldn't keep their mouth shut.
Yeah, that was me. That was totally
so,
me.
So anybody out there who's looking to become a union president, if you realize early on in your career that you kind of go around, why, what are you talking about? this is your future.
Yeah, we will suck you in as a union. We will definitely make sure we get you involved.
But that's okay, though, because think about what you just said, though, being in the union. I know a lot of people, particularly here in Wisconsin, you know, 5 years now after Act 10, I always have to remind people that, yes, there are still unions, public service unions, particularly a teachers union. They've been cut, neutered a little bit to an extent. However, you are still extremely important.
Yeah, and in Milwaukee, we've actually, in my opinion, grown in power in a lot of ways since Act 10. I know it was an unintended consequence.
I thought about this, so go ahead. You go with that, and then I'll add some more.
Sure. So when I was becoming involved in the union, an activist on our executive board, we still had agency fee. Everybody basically was a member. And what we found was, at least back then, not that many people got involved, right? A lot of people didn't even know they were part of the union because it was automatic. Now what we found is we have to go talk to people and sign them up. And we've been very, very successful at that. Our membership is about 70% of all potential folks in the district are union members. But instead of it being 100% like before and only maybe 5% being involved, we have much higher involvement right off the bat because 70% of people had to make a conscious choice and say it's a value of theirs, which then it leads to them being more involved.
Okay.
And it's definitely an unintended consequence of the law because it was supposed to end public unions, and in a lot of ways, it made us stronger.
Well, then, so I wasn't going necessarily in that direction, but I wondered about that. Yeah, from a membership, you've got to work harder.
Sure.
Right? Now, we also don't want to go out there and go, Act 10 was a good thing.
Absolutely not. No.
However, it did make you realize the fact, and I love that because I've heard that from other people, is that I'm more active now in my union than I used to be, or I sense a greater proportion of membership involved than used to be.
Yeah, and I can do, I mean, anecdotally, back in the day, we would do phone banks in our office, in our basement, for different political campaigns, and it was usually me, another guy, and the staff person doing the phone banks, right? That's who would show up. Now, many times when we do phone banks, we run out of phones in our office. We fill the basement. We have them upstairs because people know it matters to be involved, not just in the political realm, but definitely in the political realm because nobody goes into education thinking it's political. Nobody goes in to say, I want to become an educator to become a union member, right?
Right.
Nobody does that. But they go in to make a difference with their students in their classroom. And people are seeing that you need to have a strong voice and a way to push back against those who are trying to hurt the students in our classrooms by cutting public education funding, the proliferation of voucher and private charters, taking resources away. And I think for a lot of people, even though we don't like it being political, we don't like having to do it, we see no other choice. And we're going to do it because it's our students. And that's why we went into the profession.
See, and that, for me, was looking at this was to say one of the unintended consequences was to move the unions, quote, away from that traditional bread and butter wages and benefits.
Yep.
And actually now push you into the role that you always did before, but was never highlighted, but this advocacy for the classroom, for the child, for the community, for the profession. Am I missing that?
No, yeah, that's exactly our philosophy. One of the things that we did after Act 10 was take a look at where we spent our resources. And it was a lot of the traditional bread and butter issues, which are still extremely important. I'm not saying at all that wages and working conditions aren't important. They are.
Right.
But it's more than that, right? We decided we had to become a leader in the profession. And we've done that in the past in our union, but to make it this time, front and center at what we do. And we started a teaching and learning center. We released a couple of our members at that time who were considered excellent teachers by everybody that you talk to. And they started offering different sessions for other members to come in? Do you want to improve around classroom discipline? Do you want to be able to effectively do whatever the new acronym is that is being forced upon you? How do you do it so it actually makes a difference and make it relevant for you? And we found that members are very, very interested in it because they constantly want to improve on what they're doing. And there's a trust when it's colleague to colleague, when it's member to member. It's not the scripted PD that sometimes we see from administration. This is like real talk. And right. we've been able to grow with that, and it's been huge. We have different events and sessions going on in our building pretty much every night of the week. Sometimes we actually run out of rooms because we don't always plan very well and schedule too many, but we'll have 30 to 40 different members per night in our office working on some new project or an old project, making it better, just to improve the profession.
So, and let's be honest, we're in Milwaukee now, too,
yes.
where there is no shortage of a need for professional advocacy at the child level, at the community level, at the school level. I mean, it's all happening in Milwaukee. Charters, choice, deprofessionalization, emergency licensure by breathing or respiration,
yes.
I like to say, license by respiration. All of these are issues that you're involved in some way, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, I would argue that it doesn't even stop there. Those are the educational issues, right? But then there's the community issues where Milwaukee has been under attack from the state. I mean, we have a governor who basically has campaigned on saying, we don't want the rest of the state to become Milwaukee. You know, and it's, first of all, maybe you wouldn't become Milwaukee if you'd actually fund us and help, you know, jobs.
I just want to say, I drove through there Saturday with the sun shining in the lake, and it was pretty cool. I was like, I'm not sure, so sure why that's a derogatory statement.
I don't know either.
Looked pretty to me. The museums look great. The restaurants I've been to, I've had good food. I've never left, you know, so I'm thinking Milwaukee's a pretty cool place.
I love Milwaukee. I still live in Milwaukee. I plan on living in Milwaukee for a long time yet. I think it's a great city. We have our challenges like any other city. As poverty grows, we see the effects on our communities. But that's not unique to Milwaukee. That's actually, we see it outstate in rural areas as well. And but it all comes back together where it ties into education, where you can't separate what's going on in the schools from what's going on in the community. And so also as a union, we try to make sure as much as we can, we're out in the community supporting different groups, being there for them. And we've seen it come back in a good way where they're there for us and our students in a lot of ways. An example that I like to talk about is a few years ago, the county bus drivers went on strike. They were in a contract battle with the county executive, and we helped them out. We had our members went and walked the picket lines with them, and it wasn't, you know, a direct tie-in to education. You're like, why county bus drivers? Why are you involved? Well, one of the things they were striking over was to keep bus lines open. Those are used by our students and our parents. And so we were there, and they ended up being relatively successful. They got their contract. But what we've seen is now at school board meetings, when we pack an auditorium, intermixed in the crowd are county bus drivers wearing their uniforms who will come out and support our issues as well. Because I think the goal is to work with other groups and see that it's all the same battle.
We are talking to Milwaukee Teacher Education Association President Kim Schrader. Kim, we were talking a little bit about how you had an alliance with some of the local bus drivers, and I was talking about social justice because I want to throw that together because that to me sounds like that's the issue at hand here. Is the union moving in a more social justice direction to talk about the idea of, you know, there's a collaborative community aspect that the union can help bring people together for a justice issue?
Yes, I believe we are moving in that direction, and we have to. Because, again, like you said, it's a justice issue. And what happens in the communities with our different allies or different groups, these are our parents, our students. We're in the same fight, and we have to do it. And so, I mentioned the bus drivers before, but we've also last year worked with Voces de la Frontera to get MPS to be declared a sanctuary district. And, you know, we're really proud of that because our students are affected by the potential raids and everything else that's going on, in our country, but in Milwaukee as well. And so we wanted to make sure we were there, and we still are looking and having conversations with VOSAs to figure out how can we do the next step? How can we talk to parents? How can we talk to students and bring them in a safe spot to make sure they know their rights?
So the sanctuary city, and there's a lot in the news right now about this, right? So taking that position as the union and supporting Milwaukee and being a sanctuary city, has Attorney General Jeff Sessions called Kim Schrader and said, "I want to talk to you, sir"?
No, not yet, but maybe after this program. I don't know. But we haven't had any blowback from outside groups specifically towards us. But we do at times. I'll be honest. We get hate mail. I will get hate phone calls. If it's not around the sanctuary district, it's around. We were the first local teachers union in Wisconsin to take a stance on supporting Black Lives Matter because, well, they do. And it's our students, it's our parents, it's our community. And we lost some members from it. You know, we lost 10 to 15 members, and we talked to each one. And at the end of the day, it was, basically our message was, we're sorry to see you go, but this is what we stand for. And we're not going to budge on this. Most of our members are excited, but we were targeted by one of the groups for a while, back the badge. Again, a lot of hate mail, a number of hate phone calls, and we're very consistent. We're not anti-police. We're just there to support, to make sure that procedures are followed. And our Black and brown folks in our committee or in our communities are treated with the same procedures, respect that everybody else is.
Right.
And we're seeing that, unfortunately, that's not happening. And you have to be blind not to see it.
Yeah. Well, all lives matter, Kim. Right. Yes, we know how.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Right.
But I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to feature that of saying that, seeing you guys taking an active stand like that, the Milwaukee Teacher Education Association, and saying a Black Lives Matter week. In fact,
yes.
Coming up here, right?
Yep. Coming up. First full week of February, I believe. We will be encouraging our members to wear their Black Lives Matter t-shirts in the schools, as well as teach different curriculum throughout the district that highlights social justice issues. And our district, in this case, has been very supportive. Our school board passed a stance a couple years ago after we took a stance supporting the Black Lives Matter movement as well. And it's been a nice collaboration.
And I like what you're talking about here about the teaching aspect, too, because you're coming back at this because, again, somebody who wants to, quote, throw unions into this radical group of terrorists who are out there, of course, they're behind Black Lives Matter. But no. You've talked about this too, saying there's an education opportunity here, and that as a union that represents teachers and kids in schools, we are also going to be then supporting teaching about what this Black Lives Matter movement is, curriculum. So it's not rabble rousing, it's educating. However, sadly, though, sometimes today, even educating is taken as being a rabble rouser.
I've noticed that. And, looking
that
back.
That fits my description.
Exactly. Looking back at different times in our history, though, especially in our country, I think that's always been the case, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever you're trying to change something, especially if it's entrenched and you're challenging the status quo, the powers that be. They don't always necessarily want you talking to folks, don't always want you to be presenting different ideas, because that threatens them. And so we understand, I mean, I understand it on a theoretical level, but at the end of the day, these are students' lives we're talking about. These are the parents of the students, and what kind of society do we want to live in? And we're going to do this because it's the right thing to do.
No, you, a union member just said they're going to teach for the right reasons. I can't believe, I thought,
we're blowing away
this whole wages and benefits kind of thing here, you know.
I try so hard to be a union thug and then just fail. But wages and benefits, I mean, you and I both probably agree, but sometimes that still will get the play in the news, right? As soon as the contract comes up, which in Act 10, Wisconsin is every year. And we're arguing to make sure we maintain and attract quality folks. It's the greedy teachers union all over.
Sure.
And I mean, we have a school board member who says constantly, the only time I still ever see the MTEA out at a school board meeting is when they want more money, ignoring, you know, the 40 other times in the last year we've been out arguing for.
In fact, a couple of weeks ago when your members were there pointing out the fact that the board was maybe doing some kind of hanky-panky
things.
Now, they don't want to remember that time.
No, but it still is very easy for people to just lump unions in, even with all the different things we're doing. But we're still going to keep doing all the things we're doing.
Well, and let's not take away from the fact that there is absolutely, I don't want to even say nothing wrong, but to advocate for wages and benefits for a profession so that teachers can make a living.
Yes.
Doing the job of teaching children, having reasonable benefits that anybody should have. You know, it was interesting being in Pennsylvania when Act 10 first happened to watch this. People used to ask me to comment on this. And I said, well, why is it so bad to ask to be treated professionally, not above it? And why are we telling people? It was the argument, it was the backwards argument of saying, how did we turn people into saying, well, if I don't have that, then they shouldn't, instead of saying, we should all have a decent salary, not extravagant, and we should all have benefits. And so we're glad you're still doing that work.
And thank you. Right. I mean, and I completely agree with you. And, you know, it's a constant struggle over time in that sense, where it hasn't changed, where those who, again, have the power, the 1% who have the money, will constantly say, oh, they look at that group over there. They want to they want a dollar an hour raise. That's going to really mess you up. Just ignore the big tax cut I'm getting. Right. And we fall for it all the time.
Right.
And that's also, though, I think why it's important to be out in the community talking to other groups, because it builds a sense of trust. And I think that's one of the most huge things that we can do. And also, when we go to other groups, we don't go to them and say, hey, we got this thing, how can you help us? It's us going to them and saying, we see you got this going on, how can we help you, right? And that's how you build the trust.
Well, it's Milwaukee Teacher Education Association. It's the president, Kim Schrader. Kim, as we're coming to an end, though, this is pretty cool, because I'm glad you're here, because we are going to announce that MTEA is now going to be one of the first official sponsor of the Busted Pencils radio show.
We're really excited about it, and we are happy to help this get going in any way we can.
Well, I just want to say, from Busted Pencils and the Busted Pencils listener, thank you so much for taking the time to support us, come here and talk. For anybody who wants more information on the union and we want more membership, what's the easiest way?
The easiest way is to go to our website, mta.org, and you'll find it, or just Google MTEA. But also, we talk to anybody, call our office, and we will have a conversation with you.
Kim, what we like to say here, thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio. From Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
I've been pretty open about my thoughts on teacher deprofessionalization. I do not like it. Amy Bahena is a library media specialist who is currently completing her master's degree, which until recently was an expensive job requirement. There are those that want us to believe that a trained and well-educated person is not needed for that job. Amy, I'm guessing you're more in line with me on this topic.
We definitely need library media specialists. We need people that are trained in information and education with all the pedagogy and ethics that goes along with it to meet the information needs of our students and our teachers.
So you mean to tell me the license requirements for a library media specialist are important?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Explain to me why, because I keep hearing from politicians that they're not important.
Wow. We do so much. We run technology and interference. We do troubleshooting and to help teachers craft quality lessons and find the materials that they need to teach at the varied levels within their classrooms. It's absolutely a must to have someone who knows what they're doing and knows their way around not only books, but digital resources, websites.
So there's more to it than checking in books and putting them back on the shelf?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Let's get serious now. I mean, Amy, I saw your rant on Facebook, and you really nailed this pretty hard. Here in Wisconsin, as we deregulate and de-license, but I mean, you know, library media specialist. For example, you have a master's degree, right?
I'm just finishing it. I'm taking my last classes towards my master's degree in information science.
And This is what's really got you teed off, right?
Well, yeah, it was required. It is required currently, but they're talking about taking away the need to have a master's degree and be a licensed teacher for being a media specialist within the schools and serving our students and teachers.
Good. I mean, there's two ways we could look at that. You could have said, well, it would have been nice to know before I spent how much money have you been spending for your master's degree?
About $40,000.
Okay, $40,000, which isn't being reimbursed in some way, shape, or form. So it would have been nice to know. And or the other argument, which is, no, lowering the standards actually takes away my prestige? Or is that a combination?
It's a combination.
Okay.
And it's not only my prestige. It's not for me. It's for the students and the teachers. If we don't have this requirement to have fully trained information professionals in our schools, it's a disservice to our students who deserve someone who is able to find information and the best resources for our kids and our teachers to create quality lessons. So it does. It undermines it. And it creates a market then that makes it easier to get a cheaper, under-certified, under-trained person in this role if they lower the licensing requirements. And so I'm leery of that, and I'm afraid for our staff and our students they're going to suffer.
And so it sounds like you're kind of leaning towards the deprofessionalization route that I know a lot of listeners to Busted Pencils, you know, have heard me talk about. But I don't know that people have moved into the realm of a library media specialist in recognizing that you too have advanced certifications. And in fact, as you just talked about, the mass of information that's available, not just in books and stacks in the library today, requires a depth of knowledge that you can help me as a dumb idiot as I walk into the library and go, I need to look for this. You can.
our teachers aren't dumb idiots.
No, I said me.
Help them navigate that plethora of information that's just coming at them, you know, and we're able to find it quickly and help them the best we can. But I don't think you're a dumb idiot either, Tim.
Oh, well, thank you, Amy. But no, seriously, though, what about the argument that somebody says, look, there we need people in these positions, you know, the shortage argument. We need librarians. Mm-hmm. We need media specialists. This advanced degree is actually keeping people out of the field, and we need to lower these standards because we need people in classrooms. We need people in libraries. Isn't it more important to get people in libraries than it is to worry about keeping up the professional standards?
I would argue that in any other realm, the same people that are making that argument would say, let's say the business realm, would say that the market would allow for adjustments that would be more attractive, whether it be benefits or wages or configurations of the placement and the position. It would be more important. The market would adjust for that, and it would attract more people to the field if there is such a shortage. We don't need to lower the standards for teachers. We would never do that for engineers building our highways. We would never do that for businessmen making multimillion-dollar decisions. Well, library media specialists in particular are in charge of millions of dollars worth of equipment, digital resources, and technology, and should be certified and trained.
So how has your rant been, you know, have you gotten any responses? Have you gotten any kickback, you know, from the sarcastic side of me that said, Amy, look, I mean, you know, you just stack books, or are you getting a lot of support, or where, you know, where's it coming from? Or what?
I feel pretty supported. Okay. In my Facebook land, I have, you know, people that understand what I do. I'm a pretty fierce advocate for the work that we do in our schools and our students and our teachers and the struggles that we're all going through right now. So most of the people that I associate with in social media have been pretty supportive. Like, they understand that, and they don't understand what has been happening with our schools necessarily getting to the point where we would even consider this deprofessionalization of different certification areas.
So let's put it out there too. This deprofessionalization, this move towards undermining the license and or making the claim, is not coming from, quote, the typical Republican legislative right, but coming from the DPI with an elected Democrat in holding that position, right?
That's what I'm understanding.
Because DPI sets policy in the state of Wisconsin, and so here we have what are supposed to be advocates and friends of the public education system and professionalization being the ones leading the charge for the deprofessionalization. I mean, I've had quite a battle with this, but how is that going down in the field? Because I typically hear, Tim, look, teachers like this because it makes it easier for you now, Amy, to move around and get licenses wherever you want, because you might one day want to teach chemistry.
Well, I've made that move already, and I did make the choice to spend $40,000 and go through the intense certification process and the master's degree program that I chose because of its rigor, and I found value in that, and I think any quality educator would see the value in that. I did not feel capable of just stepping into the library media role with a few basic training sessions. It's not enough. You need to have the theory and the ethics and the pedagogy behind it in each individual role. And I'm afraid that the budgetary, the financial and political hits that we've taken in the last several years have led even people that might have otherwise been in our corner to come to the conclusion that this is the only way that we can solve these shortages, and it's just not.
So deprofessionalization, taking away standards for teachers, is not something that teachers that you know are celebrating.
Most of them, no.
Okay, because like I said, I want to go back to it, because when I've questioned this, I get the, look, teachers are loving this. I mean, they can move up and down. They can go to first grade one morning. The next day they can wake up. They can be a chemistry teacher. Principals are loving this because their ability to move teachers between grades. I mean, this is just a win for everybody. But I always point back, and I'll give you this, you know, for the last reaction here. But what is this, if it's, quote, good for principals, good for school districts, is it good for kids?
And that's the bottom line, Tim. That's the question that we need our politicians and our education decision makers at all levels, DPI, the school boards, administrators in the buildings, everyone, to be asking that question. Is this truly good for kids? Is lowering our standards really what's going to solve this shortage? Is this going to get our kids what they need to be successful? And myself and a lot of other teachers would say no, and that's unfortunate.
She is a highly qualified library media specialist from the Green Bay area. Amy, thanks for busting pencils.
Absolutely. A pleasure, Tim. Thank you.
Each week we ask an education advocate to take on the question from that amazing Alfie Cohn book. Ricardo Rosso is a professor of education at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Ricardo, what are the schools our children deserve?
Yeah, well, Alfie Cohn, first of all, is a comrade. You know, I love his work, you know. But I would say that, you know, we have to sort of take a Zoom model. You know, there's obviously there are things that schools themselves can do to change things to make it better for students. But we can't talk about the schools our children deserve without talking about the society that that our children deserve. So I think it's impossible for us to talk about one and not the other. So, I mean, when you live in a society where 1% of the population controls 45% of the wealth, primarily males, primarily whites, it's horrific. It's very hard for you to institutionalize this, you know, the schools that we really want. But, you know, fully funded schools, obviously. The fact that we fund our schools in this society with primarily state and property taxes, you know, is horrific. You know, it guarantees an unequal outcome throughout the country. With schools that have wraparound services, are schools that children deserve. I mean, psychologists in schools, therapists in schools, social workers, and nurses. We have, you know, many urban spaces where you have one nurse for like 3 or 4 schools. I mean, it's horrific. So total wraparound services, teachers that, you know, are qualified in schools. Most of our teachers are qualified, but we have a situation where we have classes, teachers teaching 30 students per class. I mean, it's a horrific situation.
Time now for our tribute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. Here is your moment of Zinn.
Pessimism becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It reproduces itself by crippling your willingness to act.
My thanks to Ricardo Rosso, Amy Bahena, Kim Schrader, and of course you. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to bustedpencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.